The Libertas Media Project rolls on, pushing back the boundaries of ignorance with the moral superiority of freedom in our post-Constitution Republic. It's been shy of 1 year, according to my limited mathematics, since our last chat with David Schellenberger, prolific writer, speaker, blogger, and the man single-handedly posting more relevant articles on Facebook than any other sentient being. David recently escaped the clutches of the People's Republic of Taxachusetts to become almost a neighbor, actually, immersing himself about an hour or so away in the bucolic suburbs of Charlottesville, here in the Old Dominion. Fortunately, David is safely out of the grasp of the notorious Virginia Alcoholic Beverage Control muscular men in black who dangerously prey on unsuspecting UVA college students who happen to like beer. But we'll leave that to the national news. For those of you who missed David's admirable resume last time, just go to the link that's posted here at libertasmedia.com. DaveSchellenberger.com is his address for the complete package, including an 8x10 color picture suitable for framing. Dave, great to have you.
Good. Thank you very much, Brian. Glad to be here.
Welcome to Virginia, by the way. Once again, I know I've said that to you before. I know we've had lunch, but for the official record, there it is.
Right. I'm glad to be a neighbor, Brian, and the weather here is certainly much better than up in Boston, where I've spent much of my life.
You know, there is so much more happening in the world than a year ago, or maybe it's just more things have come to a boil. So rather than spend our time kicking injustice around, which is easily done, I thought we could take a look at the bigger picture, the common sense issues that we all share in suffering what seems to be this inexorable slide to tyranny. Now, your blog encourages a much more optimistic approach. Dave recently posted a piece you can read for yourself, Wake Up, Sleep Up No Longer. Come over to the bright side. Seek a world with liberty, a world without rules. Now, to the uninitiated, Dave, it looks as if there's an approach avoidance issue here. A world with liberty, great. A world without rulers, whoa. You sound like one of those anarchist types.
Indeed. And as you know, anarchy means no ruler. And I always ask people, do you need a ruler? I don't.
Only for drawing straight lines, for me. That's
exactly.
But here's the thing, and you can go to Dave's website and you'll see a cornucopia of videos and articles and references to places all around the world where David has spoken on behalf of freedom and on behalf of liberty and posted accordingly. When you approach people or the subject comes up within conversation about anarchy, I have to assume, David, that you put up with much of the same responses from other people who haven't given it any serious consideration as the rest of us do. I was curious, for example, how do you handle that? Well, no laws. I mean, how are we going to maintain order? It'll all be chaos. It'll be Wild West. It'll be Neanderthals roaming and raping and pillaging.
What I always say is that law precedes the state. It's a natural creature of man through spontaneous order. People know, in general, that it's better to get along through a system of rules, laws, than it is to engage in constant conflict. So we have law absent the state, and many of us refer to what the state calls law as mere legislation. It's something imposed on us. Real law means voluntary law or customary law that evolves through discovery.
But doesn't it give you pause with people who haven't given this serious consideration? It is such a contradiction from the common narrative. It is so outside the parameters of the paradigm that it creates a cognitive dissonance, a head-on collision between what we've been trained and taught and raised to believe versus this no-boundaries approach to natural order and human interaction.
It can be a shocking idea to people, and as you know, it's not necessarily the best path to popularity to declare that you're a libertarian, never mind an anarchist. But I also find that many people who haven't thought about the philosophy of either libertarianism or its anarchistic element is that they actually do agree with a lot of what you and I do. They actually don't like paying taxes. They don't like injustice. They don't like business regulation. So there's a natural anarchism in the human spirit among many people. That being said, this will always be an uphill battle, and I have no illusion that we'll see the type of liberty you and I seek in our lifetime or our great-great-grandchildren's lifetime. But it's always my view that we should speak the truth nonetheless. It's our moral duty to do so, and we're planting seeds. Some of them may take fruit now and in the future.
In looking at what those who have gone before us have written, people like Sander Spooner, for example. I'm beginning to think, as a matter of fact, I believe you have a piece on your website that refers to the spread of classical liberalism, written by, I believe it's George Smith, on how public opinions change. And the essential thrust of that posting that you have there is that these philosophers did all this work. They did all the heavy lifting early on, and ultimately this all spread and prepared the ground for the seeds that you referenced. And ultimately, when Wealth of Nations came along, that it wasn't so much that it was all that brilliant, but it was the fact that that Smith was merely taking advantage of the times and the fact that people were ready to hear the things that he was talking about. It was all spirit of the age, climate of opinion, as the piece references. So with that in mind, is it possible, using the pieces, for example, that you freely distribute on Facebook and on your blog, might better expedite the arrival of that freedom and that liberty and that condition and that mindset because technology has now caught up with thinking?
I think that's the case, Brian, that the internet is a great means of distributing ideas, including the truth about the state. If you and I met through Facebook, for instance, and you and I can now reach a huge audience around the world, people we'll never meet, people we never would have heard of absent the internet. So it's a great technology, and hence it's a threat to the state. And thus we see governments around the world trying to censor the internet. It is a subversive instrument. But I agree with you that given the internet, things could be expedited. That is, the truth could be spread much faster than it ever has been, and it could create results much faster than we can even anticipate.
You pointed out in that piece, currently at the top of the list at DaveSchellenberger.com, that it takes courage to acknowledge the truth, it takes strength to reject conformity, and it takes toughness to decline surrender. When you step back and look at circumstances and conditions that exist and continue to grow and fester and bloom here in America, do you get the sense that speaking the truth such as you do, that you're putting yourself in harm's way?
I think that philosophical anarchists are not deemed a real threat to the state. I think the state probably just considers us silly. But I also decided a long time ago, when I used to address crime on Wall Street, that I would not live in fear, that I would do my best to change things and accept the consequences. But I doubt that you and I have, are getting too much attention from the White House, for instance, or even the NSA, because all we're doing is discussing ideas. We're not violent people. We're nonviolent. We seek peaceful change. On the other hand, there's always a possibility that we would face some state persecution, particularly if things continue to get worse in America, which is a real possibility.
Yeah, I've often wondered when I start these interviews if I should say hello to the guest and welcome in all the people over at Fort Meade. Henry David Thoreau said, "There are thousands hacking at the branches of evil to one who is striking at the root." In the concept of and the practice of striking at the root, how would you gauge the number of people who are actually doing that as opposed to just having otherwise intellectual conversations about the variables?
I think the vast majority of people in the world don't think about the big picture. They're tinkers, and you certainly see that in American politics. And even libertarians, the vast majority of libertarians in the United States are tinkers. They want to change the system of taxation to something that they think will be better. They want to elect someone else to office. None of these changes will have any effect on the real problem. The state will always grow, will always continue to steal our liberty until we're done with it. It's a monster that feeds on growth. It has no incentive to get smaller, to do anything other than steal liberty. On the other hand, I think we've discussed in the past, the number of libertarians out there partly due to the effect of the internet, its ability to facilitate communication, is huge compared to any other time in our lives. I've said before that when I was a student at Boston University School of Law, I did not know a single libertarian in the world. And I went to school back 1975 to 1978, it was relatively recently. And I've also said that nowadays you walk down the street, you'll trip over libertarians. Now, most of them are mainstream, so I don't think they fully get it yet. They don't fully appreciate the threat that the state represents and the need to just get rid of it. But internationally, I find that there is a good number of actual anarchists. Now, they may not declare themselves as such, because in their own countries, it's hard enough to be a libertarian without going to jail, without taking what's deemed a more radical position. And even the United States, among young people, many of them actually get it. College students, recent college graduates do get it, or they're easily motivated to see the light, to come over to the bright side. So there's hope, Ryan. On the other hand, the state will not gladly give up its power. The state does not listen to arguments, moral arguments, intellectual arguments. The state is made up of men and women with guns who want to keep their power. That's why I always remind people it's merely a criminal organization. And thus it's going to take a lot of work to reach the point where a large number of people stop supporting the state and seek a better way of life.
Read a recent article I wrote, quoted my friend Walter Williams, who said, there's never been a time in recorded history when a tyrant has gotten up one morning and said, okay, this isn't working, let's try freedom. It's not going to happen. But speaking directly to libertarianism for a moment, when you talk about running into libertarians all around the world, and I noticed, too, on your website, the description at the top, Dave is a libertarian commentator, libertarians believe in limited or no government. When we discuss libertarians in this context, everyone should understand that this is small L libertarianism and libertarians, not capital L libertarians, as in the Libertarian Party. Is that correct?
That's right. Yeah. And the majority of libertarians are small L libertarians. They're not necessarily political libertarians. They may have political beliefs, but they're generally not members of the Libertarian Party. Many of them support Rand Paul, a declared non-libertarian who's a Republican. That's, my guess is the majority of small L libertarians in the U.S. Share that view. They're actually Republicans.
Taking it one step further, as again you point out on your website, libertarians believe in limited or no government. My experience has been the libertarians, both small L and big L, definitely believe in limited government. And I wrote a piece recently for LouRockwell.com, Slouching Toward Extinction, in which I attacked the notion of limited government. It's silly. It's a peeled balloon. There's no way that limited government could actually be successful. It may come into existence, but it can't possibly have any bright future. That limited government in and of itself would imply limited freedom, limited success, limited time before the leaven of Lord Acton's principle got filtered in, and those people in power would eventually rise and grow and corrupt themselves. As Acton points out, that's the downside effect on power.
That's right. As soon as you give a criminal organization the false legitimacy it seeks, you're doomed, because it's going to grow. It's going to steal more and more of your freedom and thus create a bleaker and bleaker world. The other thing I point out to people is, why would you want limited crime? Why not no crime? And I also mentioned that if you look at the traditional view, the traditional roles that advocates of limited government seek the government to provide, it's defense, police, and courts. But those are awfully dangerous in the hands of an armed monopoly. Why not have a private system of defense, private system of police, which historically the world has had, and private dispute resolution? Each of those things should be competitive. None of them should be forced on us at the point of a gun.
I guess I took my example a little bit further about limited crime and say you'd be being a little bit pregnant. You know, you can't limit those things. And of course, the courts and the police and laws, they've got to be concocted by somebody, enforced by somebody, which requires a subjective decision. And then you start filtering in the power ingredient, and you're off to the races. Do you ever give any thought or write anything concerning the question, where did the concept of government come from as a notion that some people were somehow justified or entitled to rule over others according to their rules, while at the same time maintaining their own little world of self-serving indulgence, kind of like George Orwell's Animal Farm? Where did it all get started? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, Tom Palmer has written an article for Cato's Letter. Tom is a friend of mine who works for both the Cato Institute and Atlas Network, both based in Washington. And I refer people to an article called The Origins of State and Government. And Tom points out that the origin of government, the origin of state, is conquest. I always say the origin is conquest, not consent. And Tom refers to scholarship by Mansur Olson on the concept of stationary bandits. It's hard work to be a roving bandit. It's easier to be a stationary bandit. But that expression reflects the fact that conquerors, criminals, decided that they would provide security for farmers, rather than having to raid their farms, they would just tax them. So that is, as I understand it, accepted as the origin of government. It's conquest by people who decided to stop roving, become stationary. So I always point out that the origin of government is that it's a criminal organization, and we see today that criminal nature continues in everything the government does. The state may refer to what it does as taxation, but it's really just plunder, and it engages in violence to enforce its rule. It's always looking for war in order to support itself and its cronies, and everything it does is in support of itself and its cronies. It's not a group of good people trying to take care of us. It's a self-serving criminal organization.
What can be done about that? What can be done about the organizations that teach and encourage and promote the status quo as you've just described it? They're essentially promoting the criminal organization.
I think the best I can do and most people can do is share ideas. And you and I do mass communication, so we can reach a lot of people, and we may be having effects. You know, from time to time, I'll see people who express great doubt about my views who a year or two later make remarks that are similar to what I had said. But in terms of school, Brian, you know my position is that it's virtually child abuse to send your children to government schools.
Yes.
I always say that government schools aren't like prisons. They are literally prisons. If you think about their nature, you send your children there. They're confined within an institution. Every moment of their day is regulated. They are in trouble if they try to escape the premises, and they're indoctrinated. That's the real purpose of government schools, is to create conformity and to indoctrinate children. So I believe that even though it requires sacrifice in many instances, parents are better off sending their children to private schools or homeschooling or unschooling. Now, the problem is that even when you homeschool, as I understand it, or certainly if you send your kids to private school, you're still subject to government regulations. So ideally, we want to get rid of government schools and get the government out of regulating education. It's just an inappropriate exercise of power, even if one accepts the idea of government as being potentially legitimate in any respect.
Did you go to a public school?
I did, yeah. And I discourage even the word public. You know, the government always wants to pretend that we are the government, and you'll hear Obama say that, of course, and that's a common misconception. But they're really government schools, you know. They're government parks, government everything. Every time you hear, you know, government libraries, and some of these are good institutions, and they'd be much much better if in private hands. But they're really government. Yeah, I went to government schools, and you know, way back in the last millennium, education was probably pretty good. But we always have to consider the opportunity cost, how much better it would have been if there had not been government schools, but a free market where people really had choices.
Yeah, I did attend government schools for a short period, well, maybe half my career, and then my parents had the epiphany that they really weren't all they were cracked up to be, and I went off to one of those all-boy tie and jacket prep schools not far from where you were in Massachusetts. And the education was quite excellent, and it was a society and a culture all to its own. But nevertheless, it was a great sacrifice that they made, and I get the benefit of that pretty much every day from something that I learned way back then, way before internet. I think we were still doing homework on stone tablets. But what about that? What about the language part? You know, you're a man of word. We speak to groups. And how important would you say it is to encourage people to get out of the habits? For example, like you said, they shouldn't be called public schools. We shouldn't reinforce that notion that these are somehow benign or benevolent realities. We should start encouraging people to recognize them for what they are and call them accordingly. What do you think about that?
I think that's important. Yeah, I started outlining yesterday a follow-up article to the one I just published, Come Over to the Bright Side, and it's, it'll include that the importance of that, Brian, that is listening to every sentence and recognizing the fallacies behind the way people see the world. You see this from politicians, you see it in common speech, you certainly see it in the mainstream media. But the main word I would encourage people to question is we. Everything is our problem. If we are at war, we need more taxes, it's our debt. Each of these functions is the government's, not ours. I'm not at war. I'm a peaceful person, as you are. So I'm not invading other countries. It isn't my debt. I'm not deciding to borrow trillions of dollars. This is the state's problem, not ours. And the societal problems we see are really not our problem. Our problems are the problems of individuals. There may be cultural problems, but they're best addressed not through the state, not through blaming each of us, but through recognizing that problems can be addressed by individuals.
But Dave, just as Brandeis, I believe, said, taxes are the price we pay to live in a civilized society.
Yeah, yeah. To believe in plunder, he was right. Yeah, I would say taxes are a sign that we do not live in a civilized society.
How can extortion be part of a civilized society?
Exactly.
What about some of these other things? You know, one of the ways to really raise the temperature in a room is to suggest that the police and our armed forces are keeping us safe. You know, we see the PSAs on TV all the time. Thank you for being over there and protecting our liberty. How do you handle that when you run into it?
Well, I try not to proselytize. It tends to be a waste of time. But in my writing, I have pointed out the absurdity of that, that the armed forces support the state, not the people. You know, the state and the cronies, hence the term military-industrial complex. But that is a remarkable fallacy that the majority of people accept. Hence, we're encouraged to thank people in the armed services for their service. Well, again, the service isn't to us. All these wars are counterproductive. They create enemies. They're immoral. I always remind people that the only threat to us, the only significant threat, is the U.S. government. So let's not thank the armed forces. Let's feel sorry for people who were so misguided that they thought they were serving the country by participating in this enterprise.
Boyce wanted to, but hesitated to go up to someone who served in Vietnam or any of the earlier wars and say, thank you for your involuntary servitude.
That's right. In our lifetime, we had a draft, and
yeah.
That is just a form of slavery. But we're also enslaved to the degree that we're taxed to support these wars. And the debt taken on for the wars and for the aftermath are supposedly our obligation, which again is a form of slavery.
You spoke a moment ago about trying not to proselytize, but isn't that almost a necessity if we want to move the ball downfield and encourage conversation and change people's minds and capture people's hearts into the idea of what freedom and liberty truly is?
Right. No, I believe in advocacy. What I mean is on an individual basis.
Okay.
I don't bother to I try not. I don't do a lot of, but again, you'll bump into anarchists here who may overhear your conversation. There is, as I said, there is an anarchist element, I think, in the human soul, and you'll occasionally see evidence of it. But one reason I cover the world is because I don't know what the future of the United States is. Advocates for freedom always encourage us to be optimistic, but I try to not create false hope and to face things realistically. So the United States is in trouble. History hasn't been written yet, so things may get better, but it's a very problematic country. I consider it a dangerous country. It's the only country in the world that has an empire, is engaged in endless war, and is those two make it unique. But it's also, like many countries, devolving into a police state day by day. So I encourage people who are young to consider ultimately emigrating.
When you look at America devolving into a police state, do you have a sense as to the timeline? I know you said history hasn't been written yet, and of course by then it'll be too late. But looking forward, seeing the way the country has changed just in the last 4, 6, 8, 10, 12 years, do you get a sense that this destination, a police state, is getting closer and closer, faster and faster? Or is it like the old analogy of the frog in the pot boiling water and is going to still take a considerable amount of time, as far as the government is concerned, to be able to show their true colors?
You know, it turns out that frogs may be smarter than people, because I recently read an article pointing out that that was a bad metaphor, that frogs just jump out of the pot. People just sit in the water and join it till they boil away. So out of fairness to frogs, I'll make that point. But, Brian, I'd say we're already in a police state. It's a question of how much worse it will get. If you look at the level of police abuse out there, it's just horrible. I post some stories, but I only cover a tiny fraction on Facebook because they're just endless. If you look at the fact that the NSA listens and records apparently virtually every phone call, or can do so, every email, and just archives things in case they ever want to investigate us, that's a police state. We're way, as your friend Judge Napolitano often points out, all of this violates the Constitution, never mind natural rights and any sense of decency. So I think we're already there. The question is how much worse it will get. On the other hand, there's always the possibility, through events that we can't currently imagine, that things will be turned around. And even politicians will react if there is mass objection to policies. Once Snowden revealed the NSA abuse, he naively thought that the exposure would lead to change. I warned people at the time that the state has no incentive to change absent a good reason, such as the majority of people protesting, and thus politicians getting fearful that they won't be elected or will otherwise lose their power. But things haven't changed. So the NSA, if anything, is worse than it was a couple years ago. So, my point is we're already there. People have to recognize we're in a police state, and again, while the frog analogy is imperfect, it makes a good point that incremental loss of freedom makes it easier for the state to get away with it. If overnight we lost most of our freedom, people would object, they'd notice the change, but people are born into less freedom than their parents and grandparents had, so to them it's normal, and then week by week, year by year, there is a greater theft of freedom, and thus the reaction isn't there. The other problem is, if you look at the number of people who are employed by the state or employed by its cronies, that tends to be an extremely large number of people in America. And the more people dependent on the government, the greater it is, the greater the likelihood that they won't resist any further encroachment on their liberty. They're part of the system.
I was just making a note here to contact Ben Franklin and tell him you just shot his frog boiling right out of the water. But I still think it would be safe to say, and accurate to say, that incrementalism, which is the whole point of his analogy, is the cancer that is caused by inhaling too much government. The initiative to fight against it and give them analysis so as to get to the root is just not employed by a whole lot of people. As long as Dancing with Stars are on, then we're in pretty good shape. But I strongly recommend that people take a visit to DaveSchellenberger.com. You've got a wealth of information up there, as well as your writings. Look you up on Facebook and everything else.
Right. Yeah, all states are the same. They all seek power. They all take care of themselves and their cronies. So every story that I share on Facebook, which is my main means of addressing these issues, tells the same story we see here. It's just these are the result of the character of government, the nature of government. So we're going to see the same problems around the world.
It's always great chatting with you. Keep the conversation going.
Very good. I look forward to it. Thank you very much, Brian.